Christina Eisenberg is a conservation biologist at Oregon State University, and she wrote the book The Wolf's Tooth: Keystone Predators, Trophic Cascades, and Biodiversity. In this interview, we talk about why wolves and other top predators are so important for the health of ecosystems. So in your book, you explain biodiversity and ecosystem stability, and you address a very interesting question, namely, why is the Earth green? Maybe we can start there. Why is the Earth green?
So the Green World Hypothesis was created in the 1960s by three scientists who realized that maybe the reason we have green plants covering the Earth is because the animals that eat them are being controlled by predators. So if you don't have predation in a system, in any system, whether you're talking about an ocean system or a forest, what happens is the animals that eat plants that are herbivores, such as deer, will greatly increase in number and will eat themselves out of house and home. And so instead of having this lush green earth, what you'll end up with is barren, denuded, degraded plant landscape. So that's the Green World Hypothesis.
And let's just talk also for a moment about the term trophic cascades, which is the subtitle of your book. That, as far as I understand it, just basically, it's the same idea. It's about the food chain keeping ecosystems in balance.
Yes. So the Green World Hypothesis was like, it's like dropping a bomb in the ecological community, and it sparked very, very lively debate that continues until today. So it was just this theory. Nobody had tested it. It wasn't based on science. It was just this idea. And so Bob Payne at the University of Washington decided to test this revolutionary concept. And he worked with sea stars on the coast in the what's called the Rocky Intertidal Zone, the area that where the tide comes in and out and reveals rocks and sand when it goes out.
By sea stars, you mean like what we call starfish?
Yes, yes. Sea stars is what they're called today most correctly by scientists. But yes, starfish. So starfish, most people don't realize that they're ferocious predators, and they eat mussels. And so what Bob Payne did was this experiment where he plucked these sea stars, and they're bright orange, plucked them off certain plots along the rocks, and wherever he removed them, the mussels increased in number tenfold, and they ate themselves out of house and home. They ate all the vegetation that was on the rocks, all the algae. And that created a situation where very few other species could survive because there was no habitat for them.
Now, you write that predators and their prey, like wolves and deer, for example, regulate each other's populations. Well, wolves regulate deer and elk populations by eating them. How do wolf populations themselves get regulated in the wild?
You know, there's a thought that the Earth will only sustain as many of a particular species as is sustainable if these species are left to their own devices. And it could be that way with animals such as wolves. There are places, I'm from Montana, and up north we have a whole lot of wolves, and we're seeing that these packs, they're filling in all these places, but their numbers in some places appear to be reaching what's called a dynamic equilibrium. And so as long as they have abundant food and space, they need a lot of space, you know, they will continue to increase in number. But when their territories start to get filled in, they kill each other, wolves do. They're very territorial. And we've seen this happen in Yellowstone where their numbers have become thinned by competition between the packs.
Now, what is the relationship like between wolves and other predators, like bears and large felines? Are they all equally able to regulate the populations of herbivores like deer and elk?
That's a great question. No, they're not. And that this is what Bob Payne and others have done, is they've identified certain species that, you know, the full definition of a keystone species is it's the dominant predator in that system, so it dominates all the others. That means that while there may be other predators, alone, they can't have the same impact as that keystone predator. So in a system that has cougars and wolves and bears, what happens is the bears, they're not keystone predators because they're omnivores. And while in the Southwest and the Southern Rockies, they do eat a lot of meat, they eat mainly elk calves and fawns, and they scavenge carcasses left by cougars. On their own, they can't exert very much pressure on a deer or elk herd. They tend to hunt alone also. So they're not going to consume as much as, let's say, a pack of wolves would. Cougars are solitary stealth hunters. They surprise their prey. They pounce on them. They don't form groups unless a female cougar has her young with her for a while. And so the amount of meat that they eat, that they consume, will be lower than a group of wolves. Wolves, they hunt in groups. They don't surprise their prey. They run their prey down. When they kill an animal, they like to kill large animals because it's much more efficient for them. So they'll take down an elk, and each wolf can remove 20 to 30 pounds of meat right off the bat. So all of those things combined contribute to their being a keystone predator. However, scientists are still trying to figure this out because we don't fully understand these dynamics. You know, what makes a wolf that keystone? How come the other species aren't? Or is it possible that under certain circumstances they could be?
Laurie Santos is a professor of psychology at Yale University and studies capuchin monkeys, exploring, among other things, their buying and selling, essentially market-based behavior.
You actually taught them to use currency. You gave them little coins and taught them to basically, I don't know about sell, but to buy their food.
That's right. And the shocking thing about this work is when we got into it, we just sort of asked, you know, can we get monkeys to do this? What we were really impressed by is how quickly they were able to do it. So the monkeys picked up we introduced monkeys to these little metal washers. They kind of look like little quarters, and just train them that they can use them to pay for food from human experimenters.
How did you do this? I mean, how do you communicate with them?
With the tokens was just to give them the tokens and have a human experimenter standing there who's kind of holding a nice piece of food that the monkeys want. And they're curious creatures, right? So they'll pick up the tokens and kind of investigate them. And then, you know, a savvy experimenter can kind of sort of force them to do a quick swap with the token and, you know, grab the token and hand over the food. And really as quickly as that, they pick this up, like, aha, these tokens can be traded for food.
What kind of social or cultural differences do you have between one group of capuchin monkeys in one place and another place? Maybe one's in a laboratory, one's in the wild.
Yeah, it's a great question, and actually one that's relatively understudied. Often when you work with these groups of animals, there are only small numbers of individuals, so it's often hard to compare whether the noise you're seeing and the differences are really big differences across cultures or actually differences, you know, just in the idiosyncrasies of the individuals you work with. But those who work with wild populations have actually seen really interesting cultural differences across different groups of primates that have been studied, particularly chimpanzees, where you see different tool use traditions, different kinds of social traditions across the different populations. One of the neat things about that work is it seems like those differences aren't due to just ecological differences. So in other words, it's not just that one group doesn't use a tool because they don't have access to those materials. The differences, as far as we can tell, seem to be richly cultural for these apes that folks are studying.
So basically, somebody figures something out and they pass it on, and just like in human culture,
it grows and develops. Yeah, and so one of the questions is why you don't, the psychologists refer to this phenomena of ratcheting. So you get more and more and more technological innovation over time. Other animals, particularly other apes, seem to have this. The question is why it doesn't ratchet as far as it does, of course, in human cultures where, you know, no other species on the planet is, you know, doing what we're doing right now, talking to each other. You know, none of them are doing what your listeners are doing, which is using technology to kind of hear other people that they can't see. So the question of why other species never get to that point is actually a very interesting one, and one for which we don't have a great answer yet.
So how far have you gotten with studying that
with these kinds of questions?
Yeah.
So primate researchers have actually figured out a couple interesting things. One is it seems like humans, more so than other primates, are really slaves to watching others act. So there's a set of studies, both with human children and with chimpanzees, where you give these populations some tool that they can't figure out. So it's usually kind of some opaque puzzle box that they have to use a tool to open. And because of the opaque nature of the box, it's not easy to figure out how this thing works. And what you find is that in that case, both chimpanzees and young human children will imitate the actions that they see others take, which is a smart strategy because if you don't know how it works, watching the way others act is pretty good. But now you mix it up a bit. Now you give chimpanzees and children the same puzzle box, but the whole box is clear. So now it's really obvious how it works. And what both of these populations can see is that you actually don't need to use the tool in the way that this actor is using the tool. So you see someone act on this box and you realize they're acting in a really stupid way that doesn't matter for actually operating the box. What you see with chimpanzees, when they get to use the box, they just use what they know and figure it out. They ignore completely what the person does. But human children, interestingly, do something else. They actually slavishly copy what they see another person do, even though they can articulate to you that it's a stupid way of going about doing something. So the claim is, it seems like there's something about humans that really takes into account what other people are doing, almost in a very slavish way, where we can't avoid copying others. This is stupid in the context of, the experiments that we set up, which make, human children.
Yeah,
in this
case, makes chimpanzees look smarter than their human
kids.
Counterparts.
Yeah, I mean, but oftentimes where we find ourselves imitating is in cases where, we might not know how things work and so on. Probably none of us would be able to figure out, how an iPhone or a computer or a car worked if we didn't have lots of people showing us. We live in a causal world that's way more complex than other species have.
We think of ourselves as the most rational animal, but what you're saying would indicate that we're highly irrational in that we look to the social group more than we look to the phenomenon at hand.
Yeah, I mean, in so many different contexts, what we're learning is that, humans aren't as smart as we think. We often use these really quick rules of thumb, whether it be watching someone else or paying, just using some sort of quick and dirty strategy. I think the most ironic thing is that not just that we use these strategies, is that we refuse to believe that we're irrational. We like to think of ourselves as, kind of maximally smart and maximally rational and flexible. And when you actually do the right studies, it seems like we might not be. Embarrassingly, we might be worse than other animals sometimes in this regard as well.
Here's David Krakauer. He's an internationally known scientist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and he delivered a series of lectures on the evolution of intelligence on Earth. I asked him about the nature of intelligence and how definitions of what we call intelligence have been used to separate groups from each other.
Well, typically it had to do with A, elevating the status of humanity above the rest of animate life. And so humans, unlike the rest of the beasts, have souls and they have reason and consequently should be given preferential and privileged status. And that, of course, was extended to other members of our own species.
I was going to say perhaps the British are better than the Africans, savages, or things like that?
Exactly. And so, well, that's exactly right. And so that tendency really emerged in the 18th century. And so, and all sorts of stupid pseudoscientific theories, anthropometry, physiognomy, craniometry, the cephalic index, all these big words that gave a scientific gloss to what was essentially racism. And the IQ test, and here, the SAT test and so forth, grew out, actually, of those early psychometric tradition, the early attempt to give a number to what was essentially a prejudice.
I was wondering whether intelligence is, if not synonymous with life itself, but integral to life itself, because if anybody survived the hundreds of millions or billions of years that life has been, how long has life been on Earth? 3-4 billion years?
Yes.
If anyone survived that long, they must have something going for
them. Well, actually, it's interesting you say that, because I think that the prototypical theory of intelligence that might surprise people is Darwin's theory. If you look at intelligence definitions, either they're stupid, so that which is measured by an intelligence test, right, or cryptic, the capacity to acquire capacities. In fact, most of them are things like the ability to behave flexibly, the ability to adapt to changing circumstance. And those are all, if you think about it, evolutionary perspectives. And so, in fact, I'll actually show that when Darwin created his theory of evolution, without him knowing it, he was actually creating the first real theory of intelligence.
Now, there are people who say dolphins are intelligent, mm-hmm. or my terrier is intelligent, mm-hmm. or my four-year-old is intelligent. Mm-hmm. Do those statements have anything in common?
I think they have a ton in common. Without defining it, you can ask, what are its essential ingredients? Animals solve difficult problems all the time. Moving around a room, for example, right, is a very hard problem. If you've ever seen a robot that tries to navigate a crowded room, you'll understand how difficult it is. It's much harder than chess, for example, that computers effortlessly beat us at.
What role does creativity play? In other words, where do you put creativity in the whole context of intelligence? To me, it seems like a really major part of the whole picture.
It is, and I think, to be honest, it's completely unsolved. It's something I struggled with, and so everyone recognizes it when they see it as somehow what Charles Peirce called abduction. That is the formulation of a genuinely new idea, right? Not just solving an idea someone else gave you. There is no theory, I think it's fair to say, that we have that can explain how new ideas come into existence.